Mae Sarton has become a heroic figure to many of her readers because she's had the courage to go her own way. Sarton is 77 now, and since she was 45, she's chosen to live the life of solitude. She's chronicled that life in a series of journals that have inspired her readers to reflect on their lives as she has reflected on hers. Her recent journals describe aging alone and recovering from a mild stroke at her home in Maine. Sarton is also the author of many novels and books of poems. She's just completed her first novel since her stroke. It's called The Education of Harriet Hatfield, and it's about a 60-year-old woman who, for the first time, comes out publicly as a lesbian. It was in 1965, after writing several novels about married couples, that Sarton wrote her first novel with a lesbian protagonist. She says, "On the surface, my work has not looked radical, but perhaps it will be seen eventually that in a nice, quiet, noisy way, I have been trying to say radical things gently so that they may penetrate without shock." Most of the letters Sarton gets are from women and men who relate to her writing about solitude, and it's with solitude that we begin.
Well, I've always needed a lot of it. You see, I was an only child. My father, a scholar who was very concentrated on his work. My mother, an artist. That is, even in my family life, I was a solitary. I loved other children. I mean, I'd rush off to school early in the morning. It's not that, but solitude has always been a necessity for me, partly because I think I believe this is true of everybody. You really only experience something when you have the chance to sit down and think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said that without solitude, you feel you lose your center.
Yes, that's right. Because your center, after all, is made out of your thinking about what has happened to you. It's, I think, and it's constantly being remade. But if you too much clutter, it's just what I feel about my house right now. There's so many little things. I'm just going to get rid of the clutter. And that's what solitude does for you.
Now, how remote is your home?
Well, it's not really very remote, but there's nobody within. If I was attacked, nobody would hear me scream. It looks down a lovely field to the ocean, and what you hear all night is that sighing of the ocean. And when I first came there, I used to think that there was a train going by somewhere, and then I'd realize it was the ocean.
Do you worry about being attacked?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one, I'm a fatalist, and two, this is a very remote place, and three, it seems a very benign town. I mean, it's hard to imagine something violent happening there.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came, I did get some threats, but that was a private vendetta against me by some people. And that was frightening when I got a note saying, you know, enjoy it now, we're going to get you, and things like that.
Yeah.
But then I went to every single, I went to the post office, I went to any shops or cleaners, that kind of thing, florist, and said, told them the situation, and said, never tell anybody where I live. It's rather hard to find, and nobody has found it. So that's really worked very well.
Mm-hmm. As much as you like solitude, you've also called it your self-imposed solitary confinement. And in your journals, really, there's really quite a bit about depression.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it's inevitable. If you're a writer, a serious writer, there's bound to be some depression. You can't every day get up and say, I'm a genius and everything's great. I mean, you're fighting something all the time. You're a lot of the time you're in conflict. And some of the writing certainly comes out of that. For instance, my novel, Anger. Anger has been a constant in my life. I'm an angry temperament in some ways. And I wanted to get at that. And so I really wrote the novel to find out myself what it was all about. And this is what my writing is anyway. It's a lot of the time is to find out what I really feel, what I really think about something.
A lot of your readers identify so strongly with your writing and I think even want to be you. And you've said that there's something wrong when solitude such as yours can be envied by a happily married woman. Why?
Did I say
yes,
that?
Yes, you did in one of the journals.
Because I don't remember that, because I think it's fairly natural. In other words, uh-huh. There are these opposites in all of us. There's a part of me which would love to have a large family
uh-huh.
and now be a grandmother. And there's a part of every woman who's married and has the responsibilities of children and who just thinks of my life as ideal. I mean, she does what she wants. She gets up when she feels like it. You know, she goes for a walk with her cat. And that's the other side. It's just that we are all such a bundle of opposites, I think.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, that's really it. But then I am certainly dedicated in the sense that there is one thing in my life that I would give up everything else for, and that is my work.
Your writing.
My writing.
And yes. My guest is writer Mae Sarton. You've said that we have to make myths of our lives, and I think in a way you're making a myth of your life through always writing journals.
Yes, although I started very late on that. But I think that the answer about the myth is that you have to have an image of yourself which is viable for you. And my image of myself does have to do with solitude. There's no doubt about that. And then the enormous response to the journals, which are written, of course, in solitude and are mostly about the sort of sacred routines. Sacred is an odd word, but I really believe this to be true. And somebody compared me to the painter Vermeer recently in a thesis they were writing, because it was the sacramental of the ordinary. You remember the Vermeer women who are nearly always writing a letter or sewing or doing something very feminine and concentrated. And it the magic of these paintings, of course, is the light. But also the fact that we carry away an image of something very feminine, which is very precious. And I use even the word sacred. So I think, for instance, that if you can make dishwashing a sort of a ritual which has meaning for you, it's a tremendous advance. And this is what I try to do with my life.
Does writing journals help you think of your life in that way?
It does, but of course I'd thought all those things long before. You see, I started my first journal, I think, when I was 60.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was late in my life. My life was shaped then. And it was an experiment because I was very depressed. And I thought, if I can write about this, maybe I can solve it. It was an unhappy love affair that I was involved in. And in fact, in that book, the lover is X, neither man nor woman. I'm a little braver now than I was then. But anyway, the people, you know, are always saying, why is it X? And I just say because I was shy then and not not as honest as I am now.
Has your view of solitude changed as you get older?
Yes, I think it has in one sense, and that is that friends are very, very precious because I can't work as much. And because of heart trouble that I now have, it's not serious, I'm not going to die of it, but it makes me unable to work for weeks at a time. And then I realize how precious the friends are who can come and talk and be with me. Whereas I really haven't needed that very much until now. And I think that is something of the beginning of old age. But there's also solitude, you see.
Well, you know, I think that for a lot of people, the greatest fear is the fear of being old alone.
Yes.
And the greater fear is of dying alone.
Yes, I can see that very clearly. I'd like to die alone. I mean, I think it would be easier than perhaps having people around. But we all have death in our minds. I mean, after about 60, certainly, I think you can't escape that. I have the feeling, and I've said so in the journals, that we grow towards death. And it's the last great adventure, and we have to be prepared for it. So that I find being old in some ways very exciting, in other ways very limiting, and therefore, I get cross and I get depressed because I can't do things that I want to do anymore, like gardening.
You had a stroke a few years ago,
yes.
And you have a journal about recovering
from
the stroke. You were alone when you were stricken. How did you cope with that? How did you cope with getting to
the
hospital?
Well, I waited until 6 o'clock because I didn't want to bother anybody. And at 6, I called a friend of mine who's an RN and said, Janice, I think I've had a slight stroke. And she said, call the doctor at once. I'm coming right away. We'll get an ambulance. And the whole thing began. But you see, it was, luckily, a slight stroke. I was able to pack my suitcase, but I wasn't able to get my breakfast. And it was the left side. You see, that's where I'm so lucky, because if it had been the right side, I wouldn't be able to speak, probably. And I write about what it affected. It was very strange what goes on in your head. I mean, for about a year, I felt quite crazy. All the past just flowed through me, and I couldn't escape it. I was pursued by images of my whole life. So thank God that isn't happening now. And I think I'm now fairly well, and they keep tabs on the possibility of another stroke, of course. I mean, you take medicine and things.
You have a poem with you. Would you read that for us?
Yes, and this fits in, I think, quite well with what we've been talking about. It's the title poem of my last book of poetry, which was called The Silence Now. These days, the silence is immense. It is there deep down, not to be escaped. The twittering flight of goldfinches, the three crows cawing in the distance, only brush the surface of this silence, full of mourning, the long drawn-out tug and sigh of waters never still, the ocean out there and the inner ocean. Only animals comfort because they live in the present and cannot drag us down into those caverns of memory full of loss. They pay no attention to the thunder of distant waves. My dog's eager eyes watch me as I sit by the window thinking. At the bottom of the silence, what lies in wait? Is it love? Is it death? Too early or too late? What is it I can have that I still want? My swift response is to what cannot stay. The dying daffodils, peonies on the way, iris just opening, lilac turning brown, in the immense silence where I live alone. It is the transient that touches me, old. Those light-shot clouds as the sky clears. A passing glory can still move to tears. Moments of pure joy like some fairy gold, too evanescent to be kept or told. And the cat's soft footfall on the stair keeps me alive, makes nowhere into here. At the bottom of the silence, it is she who speaks of an eternal now to me.
What a nice poem. You know, and I should mention that you write so much about your cats and dogs that you've had in your books.
Yes. They're very dear companions.
Yeah. Let me ask you, in 1982, you wrote out a check to a retirement community for them to hold for 5 years from then when you planned on joining. Whatever happened with that?
Well, I discovered that the people I really wanted to be with, the former dean of the faculty at Wellesley was one of them, would be about 100 by the time I was 80 and going there. So I figured that it wasn't a good idea. And then when I went to see them, I found being in the dining room with nothing but gray heads and nothing but people on the way out. I mean, having difficulty in walking as I do now and all these things, that I found it terribly depressing. And so I cancelled it. It's also quite expensive. I'm determined now to die where I am, in a house that I rent from good friends and right on the sea. And when the time comes, it would be cheaper probably to have a live-in housekeeper than to go to a retirement community. But you never know. I mean, what if I have another stroke? You just have to sort of take a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Live your life and hope it'll end well.
Yeah. Let me see if I can describe this novel a little bit. It's about a 60-year-old woman whose companion of 30 years has just died, and the companion has left her an inheritance with which she opens a women's bookstore. And she's being interviewed by a newspaper reporter, and the newspaper reporter asks her if she's a lesbian, and she says that yes, she is. And that's kind of the headline in the article. the headline is, "Lesbian Bookstore Owner Threatened." So suddenly she's kind of public and out, and after living a pretty isolated life, she finds herself in the middle of the lesbian feminist community. The novel is in a way about generational differences, I think, between older women and younger women who are lesbians. Do you see it that way?
Well, in some ways, yes. Of course, the point about her coming out as a lesbian is that she is threatened, and that it isn't that she's sudden, that she's... people attack her because the bookstore is not like what they are used to in a somewhat blue-collar neighborhood. So that the book is about homophobia, mm-hmm. It's about how strange it is that so much hatred and violence can be created just by the presence of, in this case, a very discreet elderly lady who opens a bookstore. But we see these things happening all the time. And every incident in the book of violence is something I know happened. So, I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted to try to say, look, I mean, here we are. We're just ordinary people, just like you. We have the same problems. We're not monsters. We're not... That's what I was trying to get at. And I'm happy because I had a letter yesterday from somebody saying, Harriet is adorable. This really took me by surprise. But you've created such a marvelously warm and funny and character, which is, of course, what I was hoping somebody would say, but so rarely happens.
Well, let me ask you a few things about yes. Harriet and how, if at all, she relates to the way you've lived your life. She's a woman who is 60 at the time of the novel, and she was never really publicly out before. She never really related to other women couples, hated the term lesbian because it seemed like such a primarily sexual word. Does that describe you at all?
I think it describes a great many people, and not only people my age. I think it describes a great many women who are living together and who somewhat shudder at the word lesbian. And it's beginning now to come out. In the book I have, and this really happened to me, it happens to me all the time, a young woman introduced somebody and said, this is my lover. Well, you see, this does take me aback, but it's done all the time now, men also. There, you're right, there is a generation gap. But I think Harriet somewhat really does jump over it in one way or another.
Oh, she definitely does.
Yes.
And do you feel that you have too?
Yes, but I think it's very difficult. I mean, I don't think it's easy to come out in front of an audience of 1,000 people and say I'm a lesbian and proud of it. But I do that, but I do it with difficulty. I mean, the homosexual community is a community which is on the whole not liked. You are a little segment that is so it's not easy. I think it's wrong to say that it's easy. And I think if this book has a value, it's that in a way it takes this not easy thing with perfect honesty and not minimizing it, but rather lightly at the same time, so that you don't put it down. You read it fast and laugh sometimes. That's what I hope.
Now, in 1965, you wrote a novel called Mrs. Stevens Hears the Mermaid Singing.
Yes.
And this was the first novel you wrote that had a lesbian protagonist in it.
It was actually a novel in which I came out, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that's fairly agreed to now. Got almost no good reviews, but is now a classic. It's taught in all the women's studies at the colleges. This is very nice, you know, to know that something that you wrote at a time. My agent, Dermot Russell, one of the best in New York, he's dead now, alas. But, I mean, he said, don't publish it, May. It's going to do you harm. And I said, Dermot, let me give it first to my publishers, to Norton, and if they don't like it, all right. But they did. And my editor at Norton, Eric Swenson, said, we think it's wonderful, and we want to publish it. So this was where they were wonderful. And it came out, as I say, it was no great triumph at the time. But with time, it has somehow, like a good wine, you know, it's gotten better. I think it's a much better book than Harriet. It's a deeper book. And also, mm-hmm. it's about women's creativity and about the difference between a woman poet and a male poet.
The novel wasn't well reviewed at the time
yes.
when it came out in 1965. But how did coming out affect your career as a writer?
Well, I lost two jobs right away. One was to be head of a big public school poetry series in summer school in Philadelphia. And they told me, we just feel that this is government money and it might, you know, come out that you were what you are, and so that was the first, and then Christian Science Monitor was doing a series on poetry, which I wrote an essay for, which was to open the series, and they said they couldn't open the series. That wasn't quite as bad with me, but, you know, you pay a price, even now.
Mm-hmm. When the gay rights movement came along, did you identify or were you alienated from it initially?
I think neither, mm-hmm. because I had already come out, and also I had already made for myself a very solitary life, which was not political. So that it's not in my kind of life to march, for instance. I'm rather ashamed of this. I wish I wanted to. But I think you have to be what you are and not pretend that you're something else.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And it seems strange to me that you'd be kind of embarrassed because, after all, what people love so much about your writing has to do with the life of solitude that you've led.
Well,
and you,
yes.
you really can't have it both ways.
No, that's true.
You wrote a poem a few years ago called Myself to Me. And in your introduction to the poem, you said, "I wrote this poem when I thought I was too old to love. That was some years ago. I learned better."
Yes.
Do you still feel that way, that there's, you know...
Oh, yes. Well, I think that there's always the possibility of a person coming into one's life who excites the waters, so to speak, who makes everything happen again. For a poet, you have to have a muse. Now, when you're 77, of course, it's not the easiest thing in the world to conceive of one arriving, but I never despair.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Yes, I'd be glad to. This is a very short one, which was written for a friend of mine who's since died. But this is really about what it is to be a poet. It's called The Skilled Man, for Bill Vaughan. If someone should ask me how a poem is whittled and willed, just how it is done, you know, with what love, both wary and skilled, I'd suggest that he watch Bill make a thing that does not look hard, like the staff for an old knife, and learn that all that it takes to make a knife new or a word is the subtle exchange of a life.
May Sarton, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for reading some of your poems. Thank you.
Thank you.